So we're going to basically go through a few different segments, one of which is we want to have the what is really the Rittvig and posthumous Rittvig philosophy or ideas explained so that everybody can understand what they are, especially for anyone who doesn't understand what they are. Then we'll explain, and this is mostly going to be coming from Ravindra Saruprabhu, what is the GBC view of the Rittvig philosophy, I should say posthumous Rittvig philosophy. And then we'll conclude it with two items, which will be what is the temple strategy to avoid being negatively affected by this divisive philosophy. And we'll round it out with questions and answers at the very end. So if anybody has questions and answers, Jambavati is passing out these cards. So if anybody has questions, Malati, Mother Malati, you can sit over here. So if anybody has questions, make sure you put them out, fill out the card, pass them up here at the end. And one important thing is that until today, the temple has not had an official strategy as to how to conduct ourselves or what to do regarding this posthumous Rittvig idea. So that is one of the most important points, is that we understand what is the posthumous Rittvig position or their idea, and what the temple strategy is going to do or going to be. So that is a key point that we'll conclude with just before questions and answers, and explain exactly what the temple intends to do to clarify it and not be inflicted or affected by rumors, innuendos, or anything else, or any ideas of what or who is a part of the Rittvig philosophy, but what we'll do as of starting today. So, we'd like to introduce briefly. Of course, everybody knows Ravindra Saruprabhu, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, Jagadguru Prabhu, which we definitely give our congratulations for a safe return back from India.
Very well.
We definitely hope everything went well. Sorry for the reason why you went, of course, so we give our condolences on that regard too, but on behalf of the temple, we're very glad to see you back safely. Of course, in our far right-hand corner here is Malati Prabhu, everybody knows. And then we have two special guests. One is Sukadev Prabhu and Gauranga Kishore Prabhu. And Malati will give you a brief introduction and to them, as they're all rather new to Devasadhan Mandir. So.
And if anybody needs a pen, for the person nice pen, so before we start the introduction, the doorway should be, like, if you all could like move, there's a big space here, the doorway is blocked because everybody is kind of a drop, so it makes kind of a hard for other people to come in when the doorway is blocked. There's plenty of space here for these controls. So,
is Kajani the official note taker?
Yes.
Is anyone recording? Is anyone doing
that? Yeah, I have a recording too. And everything you say will end up on a website. Be mailed to your mother.
So, a few of you had the pleasure of meeting with Sukadev Prabhu, who was then invited here to meet all of you, to get acquainted with the project, and hopefully he may be persuaded to spend some time serving all of you and the Devasadhan Mandir and the other people of the party.
The weather warms up.
The weather may not warm up. There are warm parts here, and warm parts are better than warm weather. Sukadev Prabhu was Srila Prabhupada when he was 20 years old in December of 1969 in Los Angeles. And later on in the same summer, just to give you how things happened in those days, he was actually initiated by Srila Prabhupada. In 71, he opened temples in Tucson and Phoenix. And he also served as temple president in Seattle, Hawaii, Portland, Virginia Beach, and recently in Miami, Florida. And with his years of service, he has done book distribution. He was in one of the first traveling parties that Brady went out in vans with the Christian book, so in the public.
In Dover, Champaign.
In Dover, Champaign.
He had a large Christian book. So he did 5 books in a day with a big book distributor.
And he actually also cooked for Srila Prabhupada for 1 month. He lived in Hawaii. And he's also engaged in deity worship, both personally and when he's in L.A. Now, personally, his deity worship is a very large, extended family of Shivas. And he's staying on the ground floor of the Brahmacharya Ashram, so you may want to locate darshan. For those of you who have already had that darshan, you will appreciate the just to give you an idea, probably about 80 pounds total weight of your shoes.
The weight of the world.
Pardon?
The weight of the world.
Exactly.
The whole universe.
And I also invited Ram Kishore here. I'm sorry, he's based in Vrindavan. Ram Kishore is the son of Narada Muni and Rasa Leela. And he went to Gurukul until the age of 16 in Taliban and then on the Reiki. And after that, he went to the University of Florida and graduated with a degree in psychology. And he spent 2 years in voluntary training in Chapati. And now he is preaching based out of his daughter. And so please welcome both of these wonderful. We have an older generation and a younger generation. So please welcome both of them.
So next on the agenda is now we are going to find out what is the Ritvik and the posthumous Ritvik philosophy and learn some of the history of how it even came into being.
Okay. In Prabhupada's last days, the GBC sent a delegation to ask him, especially this delicate question, how are initiations supposed to go on after your departure? Nobody wanted to ask this question because everybody was praying very intensely that he wasn't going to leave. In fact, people couldn't even imagine his leaving. But still, they needed to ask this question. And they had a whole series of questions, actually. There is in May 27th and 28th, there was a meeting with GBCs in Prabhupada, 1977, his last year, and was a veil of tears. And most of the discussions were about securing ISKCON properties and legal matters and so on. There was a record made. There were 17 GBC members there, and they decided to send a committee to Prabhupada. Tamal Krishna Goswami, Satru Goswami, Jagadish, Rubinuga Bhagavan, Chirananda Swami, and Bali Mardanos. That committee went to see Srila Prabhupada, and they had five questions. How long should GBC members remain in office? How can GBC members who leave be replaced? In the absence of Srila Prabhupada, what is the procedure for first, second, and sannyas initiations? What is the relationship of the person who gives this initiation to the person he gives it to? Is there any provision for publication of other translations of Vaishnava scriptures by the BBT after the disappearance of Srila Prabhupada? So they asked these questions to Prabhupada, and they're recorded on tape. We have transcripts of it. And the GBC Minute Book For the people who were present, they gave these answers. One, GBC members shall remain permanently. If a GBC member leaves, the GBC can appoint new GBC members. This is what Prabhupada said in the state. Right now there's a whole other controversy. But here it is, you know. I mean, it just doesn't matter anymore. That's so funny. I mean. Two, so that was the first thing. Srila Prabhupada said he will appoint several devotees who shall perform initiations in the future, even after his disappearance. The disciples they accept shall be their disciples, and Srila Prabhupada will be their grand spiritual master. Three, new translations of Vedic works can be published in the future, even after Srila Prabhupada's departure, but they can be done only by one who's very expert. At present, Srila Prabhupada acknowledged there are few such men. So that was the understanding from this conversation. I don't think we need to go through. This thing has been gone through with a fine-tooth comb. The word Riktik shows up, however, in this conversation, not Srila Prabhupada's word, but Tamal Krishna Goswami put this word in. They said, after discussing the GBC members cannot be changed and so on, and the GBC should vote new people in, then Satsarup says, then our next question concerns initiations in the future, particularly at that time you're no longer with us. We want to know how first and second initiations will be conducted. Prabhupada, yes, I shall recommend some of you. After this is settled up, I should recommend some of you to act as officiating Acharya. Tamal Krishna, is that called Ritvik Acharya? That's where it came from. Prabhupada says, Ritvik, yes. And then Satsarup just keeps going. And what's the relationship of that person who gives the initiation and so on? It seems a little confused. Are we talking about now or the future? I asked Tamal Krishna, where did that word Ritvik come from? He says, he don't know. Maybe Prajumna said it. There's no such thing as Ritvik Acharya anywhere. It just means a priest. That's all it means, a priest. So there's a little bit of discussion. Then Prabhupada says, the people, these acharyas are officiating, giving diksha. The people they give diksha to, whose disciples are they? Prabhupada, they're his disciples. Tamal Krishna, they're his disciples. Prabhupada, who is initiation? Initiating. Then he says, he is grand disciple. Satrup, yes. Tamal Krishna, that's clear. Then Prabhupada says, when I order, you become guru, he becomes regular guru. He used this word, regular guru. That's all. He becomes disciple of my disciple. That's it. So everybody figured that was clear enough. At the end, the very end of this conversation, they go on to other things. Prabhupada does something characteristic. He summarizes again his conclusions. They talk about the BBT, and then Prabhupada says, Prabhupada, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Amar Ajnai Guru Hana. One who can understand the order of, that's on my order, you become guru, or by my order, in Chaitanya Charitamrita. One can understand the order of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he can become guru. Or one who understands his guru's order, the same parampara, he can become guru. And therefore I shall select some of you. So that was the conversation. That was their rather clear understanding. Then Prabhupada disappears, and of course, In July, there's a conversation with Prabhupada where Tamal Krishna comes to him and says that, see, the other issue, the issue was right now, because there were many people who were waiting to get initiated. Because Prabhupada was ill, he was not doing any initiations, and everything was waiting. He had already appointed various people in different localities to chant on the beads, but Prabhupada would still give the name, although the fire sacrifice was conducted somewhere else. And he wasn't even doing that. Tamal Krishna says, we're worried, you're sick, whether you should do this, people are waiting, what do we do? And so then Prabhupada says that he's going to select some people now to give initiations. And then he named a bunch of names. And then a day later, there's a letter sent out in Tamal Krishna's handwriting. I mean, it's his letter saying they had this discussion with Prabhupada. And here's a list of people. And they're going to give initiation, do everything, pick the name, the whole thing, but they'll be Prabhupada's disciples as long as Prabhupada is here. These are the Ritviks. And he said this would be the system hereafter. If I keep forgetting the word.
Henceforward,
right. And so then people started to take... do the whole initiation thing, this list of 11 people. Prabhupada, in the conversation with Tamal Krishna, gives 9 names, and then he adds 2 more that are in the letter. So after Prabhupada disappeared, these were the people that became the original initiating gurus. It was always understood that there would be no... more added in the future, but these were the original ones. So, but after Prabhupada left, the position of guru rather quickly became an issue. A lot of it was structural, in the sense that the way a guru acted, everybody acted like Prabhupada acted. So it was a very big ceremonial position. Each guru had a very big vyasasana, and they decided that there would be initiating gurus for different areas. It wouldn't be that in one temple you'd have disciples of many gurus, but there would be zones for initiating gurus. This is what we call the zonal acharya system. And basically, wherever you joined ISKCON, that whoever was a zonal acharya, that was your spiritual master, and if you didn't like it, you could move to somewhere else. And also, there was, every day, there was where we do Guru Puja in the morning for Srila Prabhupada, there was two vyasasanas next to Srila Prabhupada, not as big as his, but sometimes pretty big. One vyasasana for the local zonal acharya, and the next asana for any guest acharya who happened to be visiting. And during Guru Puja, Prabhupada would be receiving Guru Puja, and this personage also would be sitting on the seats, also receiving Guru Puja. This was the way it done at the beginning. So there's some controversy over this, and of course, you have to understand that when Prabhupada left, nobody had been a devotee more than 11 years. it was like that. That was the situation. Fairly early on, there was a movement that was led by a Jadarani and a devotee named Kailas Chandra, where they were passing. At that time, we had just had mimeograph sheets you could pass out. You know, there was no, or maybe photocopies were just in the vogue. And they wanted to argue is that it was clear to them that the current acharyas were not spiritually fit, and that Prabhupada could not have wanted spiritually unfit to be gurus. So they said this May 27th tape was doctored to make it appear like that, because Prabhupada would never have appointed such a person. A guru has to be a Mahabhagavata, a self-effulgent acharya.
This is Jadarani
and Kailas Chandra. Kailas Chandra told me he wrote all the papers. She was the one passing it out. And she said that no one should get initiated until the self-effulgent Acharya emerges. We should wait. Somebody called this, her name is Judy Guarino. Somebody called this Judaism, that is, waiting for the Messiah. the idea of to her and to Kailash Chandra, this rhythmic idea never didn't occur to them. They only thought that somehow or other the tape was altered. And I got a copy of the May 27th tape, and there was background noises changing, and that's what made them think that the GBC had doctored it. So I had a friend at the archives, and I asked him, could you please send me, you know, a clean copy of this tape? There was no tape ministry, you know, I mean, these things were like, it was hard to get this stuff in those days. So he sent me the tape, and it was a fresh copy. And the first thing that was clear, well, there's two things that was clear. One, in a fresh copy, another something that wasn't a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, you could see that the background noise was changing because somebody was turning a fan on and off. That was clear. The other thing was there was more to the tape, including Prabhupada's summary. You know, but they had a whole conspiracy already about this with the Judaism thing that it, so anyway that flared up, and I think some of the early Rithvic arguments were there already. And tendencies. Then you know there were then different problems with initiating gurus. I don't want to go into the details of this sad history, but eventually there was something. There was a meeting in 1984, I believe, 85. In Tuaco of the North American Temple Presidents, who all felt there was something wrong. What is it? And I was asked to have a research group to find out what went wrong in the way the gurus were functioning in ISKCON. And so this became what was later known as the Guru Reform Movement. I could see, in dealing with these people who are on the kind of most upset about this stuff, that there was a group of people, I would call them the extreme left wing. They were characterized by a great deal of personal animosity toward the gurus. I mean, really a lot of rage. And my attitude toward this was that these people who became the initiating gurus, they were Prabhupada's best people. And every Prabhupada disciple equally had Srila Prabhupada's mercy. This we know from theology, that the guru's mercy is given to anybody who would take it. So my feeling was, if they aren't good enough, okay, that's unfortunate, but why am not I any better? So I thought just there was a whole like fault-finding thing going on, which was not proper. So there was personal animosity, and then there was another kind of a tendency of people who kind of wanted to get rid of gurus as far as possible. They just wanted to level the field somehow, or they didn't like hierarchy, they didn't like higher than lower, they just wanted, they're Americans, this is all people in America. And Prabhupada was okay, but anybody else, and so I just noticed those things. Anyway, finally, you know, in 1987, the whole Dzogchenacharya thing came to an end. The Guru Reform Movement came to a something of a head in 87. And there were, in that year, a number of initiating gurus resigned or from the GBC or blooped or left or one thing or the other. And new people were brought on. The GBC was down to 15 people. And so this is where I learned a political lesson that if you lead a successful revolution, you get put on the government. So I was elected on the GBC and a few other people from the so-called reform thing. And I don't need to get into it. We had a committee of 50 do a kind of vote of confidence and no confidence on every single GBC member. There was a kind of a peer review of senior Prabhupada disciples. But the upshot was that there were still on the GBC some people who had been Dzogchenacharyas. There wasn't that they were all gone. Those who had fallen down and done outrageous things, they were gone, but Kamal Krishna Goswami was still on the GBC, Vidyananda Maharaj was still on the GBC, Jayabhataka Swami was still on, and so on. Some of the people, what I would call the left wing, was upset about that. They were really upset. They didn't like it at all. So I am with, in that spirit, then what happened about in 1989, we began this. This is where the Rithvic philosophy, as we know it now, or in its earliest formulation, showed up. It came from a group of devotees in Carrier, Mississippi. What had happened? There was a Prabhupada disciple named Nityananda Das, always quite controversial person, who was the president of New Orleans and New Taliban. And he also was a very, very intrepid businessman, and he had a big, you started out as a spiritual sky incense salesman, then you branched off into other things, and he was making a lot of money. And he was a passionate guy. And then we had this case involving a young 16-year-old girl named Robin George, who had joined the temple in Los Angeles over the opposition of her parents, and was going to the temple, and finally they seemed to act in a very brutal way toward her. They locked her in the house, chained her to the toilet. I mean, it was a long chain, but she, you know, could stay in a room and get to the toilet, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And she escaped, and she went to L.A., and then she was to keep her away from her demonic parents, and then she went to, I don't know, different places. And finally, she went to New Taliban. And Nityananda, although he was already married, he was an advocate of polygamy. And he fell in love with her, the 16-year-old girl, and wanted to make her his second wife or whatever it was. Later, when it was all over, I saw Robin George read his love letters on CBS. Because we had such a lawsuit come out of this thing. Anyway, he tried to keep her away from the parents. He sent her up to Ottawa to some friend of his there, moved her around. Meanwhile, it finally got impressed upon the leadership of ISKCON that we really had no standing to keep this girl away from her parents. And the GBC was trying to get her to go back. And they said she's in Mexico and all this other finance. Finally, she went back. She was furious. She finally went back to her parents. And then a few years later, and she pops up with this big lawsuit, 30 we were actually, eventually there was a trial and $30 million we had to. So when this lawsuit was filed by Robin George and her family against ISKCON, there was a cult brainwashing lawsuit, which was trialed in Orange County, California, which was not favorable for cults. Anyway, when the ISKCON legal department started to investigate what happened, and people just didn't even know that much about it, here comes this lawsuit. So they sent out an investigator to find out, and his report was that Nityananda was about 80% responsible for this whole thing. When Nityananda heard this, very quickly he just pulled up and left. He left New Taliban, he left New Orleans, and he left them broke. To this day, the people of New Taliban, because what happened, he had a business and there was the temple, but you couldn't see where one stopped and the other began. It was all mixed up together. So he took everything that he thought was his, and the temple thought it was the temple's, and he just disappears. And he surfaces sometime later in Carrier, Mississippi, where he bought an antebellum plantation, before the Civil War plantation, and put a Prabhupada museum there and got a whole other community going. This time he's outside of ISKCON. And he called it the... And gradually, meanwhile, by this time, most of ISKCON in North America is really broke. The era of Picanomics had come to an end, and there was not much money coming in, but he had money. And he was paying devotees to come there. And he was making a Vedic Village, and they started publishing this journal called Vedic Village Review. And then he got two former teachers from the Vrindavan Gurukula, Rupa Vilas and Karnamrita, to come there and be the Brahmins. So the Brahmins were there, and they were trying to attract everybody. At one point, I was the chairman of North American GBC, and sometime in, 89 or so, he wrote us to say he wanted to become part of ISKCON. And we said, what about Robin George? Because this is going to be a long story, but anyway, the thing was, you see, when the Robin Georges found out that Nityananda meanwhile, we had gone up to the Supreme Court, and it was going to go back for a retrial. One court had cut the $30 million judgment down to $10 million. It had gone to the Supreme Court of the United States. They were sending it back for a retrial, but the Robin Georges were almost out of money. They discovered that Nityananda had incorporated separately. He had his own property, not ISKCON. They sued him separately. Nityananda Prabhu made a deal that he gave them $20,000, and if a judgment finally came, they would first exhaust all of ISKCON's resources before they would go for any of his. That's what he did. So when he wanted to become part of ISKCON, the North American GBC said, what about Robin George? And he got all huffy about that. And so it was after that that this Riptic philosophy surfaces. This idea that what Prabhupada really wanted and really was trying to say was that he would be the initiating guru forever after. That the teaching, the consistent teaching, everybody, you know how important parampara is. And Prabhupada's teaching is consistent all the way through. Here is just a sample. Sri Nandananda found this one, but this is typical of many places. Here's Prabhupada. He's talking in December of 76, so this is a late thing. And you can find similar statements from the very beginning. So Prabhupada says on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami's disappearance day in Hyderabad, he says, so we have got this information from His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur And that knowledge is still going on. You are receiving through his servant. He means himself. Through Bhakti Siddhanta's servant. And in future, the same knowledge will go to your students. This is called parampara system. Evam parampara praptam. It is not that you have to become a student and you remain a student. No. One day you shall become also guru and make more students, more students, more. That is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission, not that perpetually. And then he says, yes, one should perpetually be a student, but he has to act as guru. You're always a student of your spiritual master. This is clear. I mean, everybody. So, but they detected in this conversation, and they also had another theory of suppressed evidence, that other things were told to Tamal Krishna and he destroyed the tapes or something, that Prabhupada wanted at the last minute, and maybe in this subtle way, to nullify all his teachings and say, now the parampara comes to the end, I'm the last initiating guru, none of you are fit or ever will be fit or whatever, and that we shall go on. And I will be the guru, and whatever you do, you'll simply do as a kind of ritual. Like a priest who does the marriage. If the priest who does a marriage is sinful, your marriage is still valid. So if the priest who does the initiation and everything is sinful, still Prabhupada's the guru. You don't have to worry. So this was what they said that Prabhupada. And they did this, you know, started to do this little analysis and of this conversation. And so this was their theory. I found out later, I didn't know it then, because they were writing in Vedic Village Review and I was responding to them and others were responding to them. But actually, one of them, Karnamrita, was a hard Ritvik. In other words, this system is supposed to go on perpetually. Rupa Vilas was a soft Ritvik. It was supposed to go on only until a self-effulgent acharya emerged, you know, a pure liberated soul emerged. I mean, and apparently you can't tell from Prabhupada's instructions the answer to this important question. It's for them to figure out. Well, at the time I didn't know there was this difference between them. We only found out later. But anyway, so this becomes a big debate in America. In fact, we had a debate in San Diego, Jayadwaita and myself on one side, Rupa Vilas and Karnamrita the other. It was videotaped and so on. You could probably still get it. If you get it from them, you'll get an edited version. Then at the GBC meeting in 90, we came out with a ISKCON journal, which was a kind of a comprehensive response to the whole all their different arguments. And the GBC passed a resolution saying that this is a dangerous philosophical deviation and that it cannot exist in ISKCON. So this is since 1990. It's been outlawed in ISKCON. It's been outlawed to practice it. It's been outlawed to preach it. It's been outlawed to support it since 1990. So the magazine came out and that was kind of a setback for them. But then what happened is the Vedic Village disappeared. These three people who are going to tell us about Guru Tattva, first of all, there was some scandal, and Rupa Vilas somehow ends up with Karnamrita's wife. Karnamrita has allegations of child molestation against him. He's English, so he leaves the country and goes back to England. Those allegations have never been tested. And then Nityananda is raided by the police and the FBI. His business was, that made all this money, is he sold paraphernalia for bikers. Bikers have like stores or places where they buy things, you know, like the leather jackets and the boots and the whatever else. And among other things, they also like to have various kind of chemicals that are used in the manufacturing of certain things like amphetamines and crack, cocaine, you know, and stuff like that. So he was shipping out wholesale in large bulk quantities these various chemicals. They're not themselves intoxicants, but it is illegal to ship them across state lines. And so there was one devotee there who had a grudge, was mistreated by Nityananda. He had called the police came, then the FBI was involved, and then when the FBI came, they noticed that Nityananda, who seemed to have an immense amount of wealth, had never on record of ever paying any income tax, which is distinctly an advantage for a businessman. And so that was the end of Vedic village. They grabbed everything. I mean, Nityananda, most of his assets were overseas, so he continues to go on. So maybe that's the end of this. But sometimes you have a fire, and it's almost out, but there's one little flame you don't see. In this case, there was a convert to Ritvikism from England, people from a Gujarati background, but born in England, named Krishnakant Desai, who got convinced to Ritvikism in England. There was a follower named, a Prabhupada disciple named Ajamil, who later rejected it. Very quickly rejected, but he did the damage of converting K.K. Desai to this this philosophy, and then he went to the Vedic village and was an understudy for Karnamrita and Rupa Vilas. And I think that when Karnamrita went back to England, he and K.K. Desai are working together, but you don't ever hear Karnamrita's name. And so later on, I don't know when exactly, in the mid-90s or the second half of the 90s, this paper pops up called The Final Order. Because K.K. Desai went back, got a degree at Cambridge, and then he was purveying this paper, although there's no name of an author on it. And that kind of ignited the whole thing again with this Final Order paper. Which purports to make this case. And again, the GBC replies to it, and other people reply to it, and again, there's this big... Now we have the internet up going, so it's really fun and games. And then another thing happens. Some of the Ritvik people decide to intensify things a little more, and they came up with the idea that Prabhupada was poisoned. Because he was in the way of the, you know, they wanted the people who wanted to be gurus wanted him out of the way, so they couldn't install his Ritvik theory. So, there was a poison controversy. They purported to hear on the tape certain whispers, which they claim said things like, is the poison going down, and so on. And people were analyzing these tapes and doing all this other stuff. And there was a book that came out about it by Nityananda again. He's a financier of the poison theory. And according to this one, you have to believe that one of the main poison conspirators is Bhakti Chiruswami. Then in 1999, in India, the Ritvik thing is spreading again. And Audrey Darn in Calcutta becomes a convert to the Ritvik philosophy. He had a very bad relationship with Jayapataka Swami, and so this time, since it's an outlawed doctrine in ISKCON and he professed it, in order to stay in charge of the Calcutta temple, he went to court. So this is where you first get this thing of we can go to court to challenge the GBC, and that's what he did. Going to court in India is bad everywhere, but in India it's really bad, and that's what he did. And suddenly, in fact, it was in Detroit that I had to send to Calcutta a document of evidence to the court that had been prepared by Audrey Dharam, sent to me. I had to sign it all, send it back to him, DHL. It weighed 15 and a half pounds in this court case, right? So if you look back, you know, one of the things that happened in the Gaudiya Math after Bhakti Siddhanta left was they went to court. And it just takes so much time and resources and everything like that. So again, the GBC reaffirmed its... Then, before the court thing, Audrey Dharam, and I think at that time Madhu Pandit, the president of the Bangalore temple, was also becoming a Ritvik, and they came to the GBC with the proposal, we don't have to decide this issue, let's just allow both in ISKCON. You know, your parampara system, as you see it, and a system as we see it. Of course, they said it was Prabhupada, but anyway. Let there be both together. Let a thousand flowers bloom and so on, you know, that kind of a thing. And so there was a GBC resolution passed at that time, in 1999, where we revisited the old law, of 1990, where it had said that the doctrine that Srila Prabhupada continues to initiate direct Diksha disciples after his departure from this world through officiating priests or Ritviks is a dangerous philosophical deviation, is totally prohibited in ISKCON, and so on. We quote this, and then we say, whereas a number of devotees in and around ISKCON, some of whom hold positions in ISKCON as managerial and spiritual authorities, have begun to practice and preach a refurbished version of Ritvikism. Whereas the GBC body has again carefully examined the case for Ritvikism as currently presented, because in its new form, there's all new arguments. The old ones failed, so, but, you know, endlessly inventive here. Having had representatives meet at various time and places with its advocates to hear them make their case, we did that, the GBC listened, and as a body, sitting in plenary session on 9th February 1999, carefully heard the case personally advocated by Audrey Dharam, Prabhu, President of Calcutta Temple, Satvik Prabhu, Vice President of Calcutta Temple, and Madhu Pandit Prabhu, President of Bangalore Temple. So they had a PowerPoint presentation, the whole thing, you know, we listened to it. Whereas the GBC body has given the current versions of Ritvikism careful attention and all due deliberation of the best its ability, be it resolved that the GBC body states that it finds the arguments for Ritvikism as represented to it by Madhu Pandit Das and other of his associates and is preached by them around the world to be erroneous in its conclusion as well as specious and sophistical in its conduct. The case for Ritvikism is false and duplicitous and its method of procedure and its selection and use of evidence. It depends heavily on speculation and word jugglery. It presents its radical and speculative departures from the consistent teachings of Srila Prabhupada, his predecessors Acharya, Srila Vyasadeva, and the Lord himself under the name of tradition and no change. The effect of these arguments is only to bewilder, delude, and misguide innocent devotees from the teaching set forth by Krishna and upheld without exception by all Vaishnava Acharyas. So then we reaffirm the 1990 law we say the doctrine that Srila Prabhupada desired to continue to act as Diksha Guru after his departure from this world and did not desire any of his disciples to give Diksha in succession after him is a dangerous philosophical deviation. Ritvikism directly goes against the principle of Parampara himself of successive Diksha and Siksha Gurus, which sustains the pure teachings and practices of Krishna consciousness. This principle has been established by Krishna and is upheld by all Vaishnava Acharyas. Indeed, it is accepted by all followers of Vedic culture. Ritvikism is thus an extreme deviation. It is utterly erroneous to espouse it. deluding and misguided to teach it, and blasphemous to attribute it to Srila Prabhupada. No one who espouses, teaches, and supports in any way or practices Ritvikism can be a member in good standing of ISKCON. And so on, and then we enforce it. We name names that these people either have to give it up or leave, and these authorities who maintain this, and we list Ajidharan, Sattvik, Madhu Pandit, Chanchalapati, the Vice President of Bangalore, Sundar Gopaldas in Singapore, and you know, if you want the Swamis, Sannyasis, some of whom have given up and come back. So that's what happened in 1999. Madhu Pandit then, well, I didn't get back to my name. Then what happened is Madhu Pandit Prabhu found a way to take the Bangalore temple out of ISKCON. We're also in court over that. This is what he did. In India, there's one ISKCON corporation. Prabhupada set it up that way under the Charity Act. His headquarters is in Bombay. There's a board of directors called the ISKCON Bureau. And the temple presidents are branch managers. The ISKCON Bureau can replace temple presidents. That's what happened to Ajidharan. By the way, we have the Calcutta temple back right now. That came back into ISKCON hands, although he's still in court trying to turn that around again. It's not that a court case ever ends in India. The major talent there is the art of delay. So, but what Madhu Pandit did was, he discovered that some 15 or 20 years ago, some devotee had registered a corporation called ISKCON Karnataka, which was not the ISKCON that all the temples belonged to. It's a separate registration of a separate association. I don't think it ever went into effect. Everything was ever done, but it was laying around, and Madhu Pandit found out about it. And so he, although it had never been acted and there was no clear succession of directors, somehow or other he made it look like there was an active board of directors. And he went to court and he got a judge who apparently didn't know what he was doing to transfer ISKCON Bangalore to ISKCON of Karnataka. And then it was out of ISKCON, even though it was called. That's what he did. So we're up to the Indian equivalent of the Supreme Court, trying to get that temple back because it wasn't a proper thing. So meanwhile, the other thing that starts to happen is we discover that in 1999, also the Ritvik people got together and decided that they were going to actually do a kind of worldwide unified program. We managed to get a letter from them. Where is it? Sorry, I don't see them. Anyway, there was a letter in 1999 where they said, we already have so many temples and now we plan to take these. It's like a sort of Al-Qaeda thing where they're like working everywhere with a really kind of centralized plan. Their idea was they would take over a certain number of temples and then they would elect their own GBC. They also wanted to go back to this original. When Prabhupada formed the GBC, he had something called the Directions of Management, which called for the temple presidents to elect the GBC. In the first formal meeting of the GBC in 1975, one of the first resolutions was that There will be no election of GBCs, but the GBC will be, Prabhupada will appoint, or the GBC will elect members. But you also saw in that May conversation, Prabhupada affirmed the same thing. So when people start popping up that, you know, we ought to go back to this direction of management, again, their argument is, this is what Prabhupada really wanted, and for some reason, since 1970, he was bamboozled by the GBC, and we ought to go back to it. It's all part, it all kind of fits in with a Ritvik scheme. The people that propose it, I'm not a Ritvik and everything like that, but it's all part of their program. There's a number of things that they do now because the whole effort now is to totally discredit ISKCON. They've also got this thing about book changes. That's another Ritvik initiative. The poison thing. Anyway, it goes on and on and on and on. So this is what's happening now. Now in America, there is now one temple, the temple that we have in Long Island. A person who was in Bangalore, who left, didn't like Madhu Pandit, but was still a Ritvik, became the temple president. And they managed to go to court again to make that their own temple without any supervision of the GBC. Also, the League of Devotees, Kirtan Ananda's old group, have this building on 25th First Avenue, and the directors there and Kirtan Ananda wanted to give that building to ISKCON. So somebody, one of the persons, I guess, who didn't like that, went to court against it.
Nikhil Gupta, a.k.a. Nikhai, my pundit, hired this lawyer, Chitlur. He's the one that pulled off the law.
Yes.
Nikhil Gupta is the president, the so-called president of Long Island. And this Chitlur is the lawyer that pulled that one off. And so the same person got that same lawyer.
So anyway, here was a temple that was, the building that was supposed to go to ISKCON, and they managed to get themselves in that case and try to get it for their cause. And we also know that they have targeted other temples in North America, just from different informants and things like that. So right now, I don't even think it's so much a philosophical. So philosophical issue, as it's just a kind of worldwide, you know, anti-ISKCON movement that's going on, and wants to use any methods possible to discredit ISKCON and go to court and take over temples. So that's where we are today. And when we found some people visiting here, and talking to people spreading the seeds from Long Island. Long Island sent people around from temple to temple to look to see where they could do something. And then some of them started coming here again and again and again. And so that's why we became especially concerned in Detroit about this. And people don't, you know, a lot of people don't know what it is. They don't know the history. They don't know the background. They don't even know exactly what the philosophy is. So I just wanted to give you this. This is the history of this Ritvik movement. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much. So anyway, I hope everybody understands at least as much as possible the history of where this philosophy has come from, that it has been outlawed within ISKCON since 1990, and the reasons for it, for the outlaw anyway. And until now, you know, basically Detroit really hasn't dealt with this problem. I mean, personally, I was a person that felt like, well, I'm never going to have to deal with it. It's not my battle. It's not an issue that I'll ever have to focus on. I don't care where it came from. It doesn't involve me. But then, of course, what happened was I got a letter in the mail, and which made their position very clear that they did have designs for Detroit. And a few of the other senior devotees did get this letter, or something similar, some of which were more divisive than this one. But it basically said, I was sad to see that you decided to sell your conscience and side with GBC in exchange for a few favors from them. In which case, I often wonder, what favors did I ever get from the GBC? I'm still waiting for them.
You're not getting any from me.
See, there you go. So, you know that they have offended Srila Prabhupada. Frankly, I don't know how you will be able to explain this to our beloved Rukmini Radhakunjabihari and Srila Prabhupada. I hope that you will still get mercy from them. Another paragraph says, you are on a sinking ship. I hope that you can see the logic, the overwhelming evidence, the reality. If you do, you will want to jump that sinking ship. If you don't, you alone will have to reconcile this with your conscience and explain it to Srila Prabhupada and Krishna. You still have time to do the right thing and feel good about it, even be a hero. Choice is entirely yours. I don't think that your job is in jeopardy. I don't know what job they're talking about. I don't even have a job.
In other words, if you join with them, you'll get to keep your position after they overthrow the...
Right. After you're gone, then I'll still be have a position in the temple, and they'll pay me for it. So he said. So they conclude, we have enough resources to guarantee that. Yours,
who says that?
You're in service of Radhakunjabihari. Of course, it's unsigned. So if, even if I wanted to take up the offer, I don't know who to approach. I'm still waiting to put in my application. So the point of it is that obviously, even though oftentimes I felt, well, even if somebody's a ritvik, what difference does it make? They have their opinion, I have my opinion, we'll just serve Krishna together. But obviously, they do have designs. They do have designs to create friction, to create divisiveness, and to create sides. And obviously, they have a design, and let me guarantee you, I did not write this letter. I have no intention of wasting my time writing such things. But obviously, they have an intention to create sides, divisions. They want me to basically disregard the cooperation with the GBC and simply join them and do whatever they intend to do, which is basically take over the temple, get rid of the temple management, really, or anybody who's in cooperation with the GBC, and can pay me for whatever it is they think I'm still doing. So then I started thinking, you know, this is a lot more serious than I thought. So this is something that the temple has not dealt with until now. We have been probably more liberal than necessary. We probably should have dealt with the situation much earlier. But again, most of us feel like, why should we, you know, begin to change the situation or basically outlaw people from coming here as the GBC has done since 1990. So anyway, those are just some of the things that have happened around Detroit. These are some of the things that have happened within ISKCON, which has a long history. So as of today, what the temple intends to do, if there are any particular people known for being ritviks, then we will simply give them a letter of non-invitation so that they can understand that it would be approved if they went someplace else. That's all. We don't really condone or agree with any strong-arm tactics, but if there is anybody that's identified positively by particular evidence of being a ritvik, then we'll simply give them that letter. Of course, that letter does mean, and it does say, that if they continue to come here, we do have the right to call the police on them to have them removed. We would prefer that not to happen. But it also means that we're not going to judge people by rumor, by innuendo, or anything else like that. That also means no one else has the right to conduct their own investigation or decide for themselves who is a ritvik and who should not be a ritvik. That also means that if you have a particular idea of what a ritvik is, which should have been clarified today, If you still have your own particular ideas of what arithmetic is, and someone doesn't agree with those ideas, that does not give you the right to turn around and say that person is arithmetic. You know, these things have to be clarified. What clarification do you need? You need clarification in the sense that, well, are they passing out back to Prabhupada magazines? Are they saying that all the gurus are fakes and frauds? Are they saying that we should not recognize or cooperate with the GVC? These things are obvious points of evidence which would then justify a further investigation into the matter, which is what the board of directors will then do. We do now have a legitimate and qualified board of directors, legally speaking is what I'm saying, and that consists of Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, Malati Prabhu, Jagadguru Prabhu, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, and myself. We will collectively decide if there is a need to give anyone such a letter. No one else can basically decide that for themselves. So we have to work in cooperation, that kind of cooperation. And in the meantime, we all have to work in cooperation to push on the mission of Srila Prabhupada. We all have this as our responsibility, this mission, this legacy of Prabhupada. So in order to do that, we need to make sure that we're all sincere in the mission of ISKCON. If there is someone who is a Ritvik and they're saying that, you know, we don't have to follow the GBC, then obviously that's going to create friction, that's going to create confusion, that's going to jeopardize the future of the movement, and quite honestly, the future of the world depends on a legitimate and genuine spiritual philosophy, which is so absent in the world today. And right now, I think we all know that if we don't cooperate, if we don't work together, the future of this world is also held in balance. And so we need to cooperate, we need to work together, we need to deal with as many people as possible that are sincere with the efforts of ISKCON and Prabhupada's instructions. So from this point on, I think everybody needs to know that's the position of the temple. That's what we're going to do. We're simply going to give them this letter of non-invitation if anyone seems to be engaged in this type of Ritvik practice, which you can see from the history that Ravindra Swarup gave, is full of particular tactics that they have used time and time again. Whether it's in the Long Island Temple, or Bangalore, or India, when we start recognizing those particular tactics here, then obviously that says one thing, is that there's a need for action. And we will judge or investigate what kind of action we should take, or who should get such a letter. So I think that is one thing that needs to be established from this point on, that that's our premise, that's what we'll do. Once again, don't spread rumors, don't depend on innuendos, don't depend or even take it upon yourself to make such an investigation or claim others are Ritvik without proper evidence. Because it just creates more divisions than there already are. So, everybody take this into consideration, and hopefully we can all work together more cooperatively and help push on the mission of Srila Prabhupada and help to make this temple an effective preaching project for the benefit of everyone else. So we do have a little time left. So for those people that do have any questions, Jambavati had passed out these cards. So we will give our illustrious crew of personalities here, GBC representatives, the chance to further inform everybody on this particular issue, or if you have any questions otherwise, to bring your cards forward. Don't raise your hands. I don't want to see any hands.
Put them in the basket and keep passing it out.
I don't want to see any hands. Take a card. If you don't have a card, get a card from Jambavati. And then just Jambavati will bring the basket forward and we'll get through as many of them as we can.
By the way, I forgot to mention, 2 years ago, Rupa Vilas, one of the original architects of Ritvikism, I forgot to say this, but Rupa Vilas is one of the original writers in Vedic Village wanted to come back into ISKCON, and he wrote the GBC a letter, because we expelled those people, wrote the GBC a letter saying that he's no longer a follower of this Ritvik philosophy. And he said, in any way, he was always a soft Ritvik. He only thought this should be in force until there were, you know, liberated gurus. But now he thinks there are liberated gurus in ISKCON, so it's a moot point. So anyway, he sent this letter of apology and recantation. So he was GBC passed a resolution admitting him back into ISKCON. That's one. I just have to say that. We can't raise hands, right? We have to ask.
No hands. You have a
no,
question.
Not a question. Now, there was a post on the internet about the Ritvik issue in Adi Raj's name, but that's not this Adi Raj.
Oh, thank you.
That person's, it was Adi Raj 108, but my address is Tom Milano 108. I don't know who that is who posted that in my name, or if there is another Adi Raj.
Well, this is a good point. This is how people get implicated in these kind of rumors when, you know, that's not really the case.
Well, so, we could have heard the, hey, Adi Raj.
Anyway, I want to make one statement, not a question, if you don't mind.
It's up to him. He's a...
So can I make one statement?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Anyway, just Prabhupada made this movement, and he said there's a whole world can be in this. Means he made a house and whole world can be. If you give a letter to all the Ritviks, please don't come to the temple, how they can live?
That's a question. That's
that's against the whole policy of this issue. Just see how people are trying to weasel the rules of it.
So this, I think, Prabhupada said the whole world can live in this house. We made a house and the whole world can live.
No. Let me answer that one quick question. We give everybody the opportunity to live in this house. But if somebody's determined to burn that house down, are you going to be so liberal? You have to understand what the difference is between those that are sincere and those who are not sincere.
We can find out the reasons for why they want to burn the house and can change them. And they can not burn, if they blow some the house. How about that?
If they're that sincere, then they won't be interested in burning down the house at all.
We will find out the reasons and we can change them and make them help us and blow some this house rather than burn the house. You have to do that, and with the philosophy of Prabhupada, you can do that.
But it is a fact that occasionally Prabhupada told people to go away and not come back.
This is just how I want to say that we don't have to just reject that and tell them don't come to the temple. But just if they are very violent and they want to burn, then we can find out that they don't burn the house. Just we can tell them, okay. We can discuss with them and find out what is the problem of difference of philosophy and the thing, and we can also just help them
I don't think we're opposed to dialogue.
So there is,
but it's just like this. There's a question here. Will you stop me from coming to the temple if I disagree with the policy? We won't keep you from coming to the temple. It's like if you are a Ritvik, the situation is you can come to the temple, just don't preach Ritvikism here. Don't, you know, spread it around to other people. You know, at least at the temple. In other words, don't make the temple your preaching ground to for something that opposes ISKCON.
The last thing.
Otherwise, what's that going to do?
This last thing, Prabhu.
Hang on, let Pandit finish, please.
Yeah. The reason I asked that question, it was provoking.
What was he talking just?
No.
Go ahead.
We only got so much time, so let Pandu.
The reason I asked that question is, I do kind of disagree with it because I think it's based in fear. You see, I think it's the politics of fear that I have this, you know, maybe irrational view that, you know, Krishna's in control. And that these rascals can't defeat Krishna, you know, if they're actually out to attack this movement. I support the GBC because Srila Prabhupada said, you know, his spiritual master said, you know, there should be a governing body commission. So Srila Prabhupada installed it. And, you know, right, wrong, mistakes, right on, whatever they're doing, it's in line with what Srila Prabhupada wanted. And I also know that sometimes Srila Prabhupada disagreed with the GBC. Even here in Detroit, you know, there was some movement to get rid of the original Govardhan that was president, temple president here. And, you know, Prabhupada said, I don't care what, you know, you're accusing him from. He's doing like service. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's the intent involved, you know. And disagreeing, it just seems so divisional. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you can also understand the divisional character of the people that are hardcore Ritviks. In other words, if you'd been listening to the history, you can understand that we may like to welcome them to the temple and everything like that. And I personally would like to do that. But, once again, you can see from the history of what they've done, they've created some really, really difficult situations which would better not to have happened at all.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So somebody comes to the temple and you find that when nobody's looking, he's stealing money out of the hundi box.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell him that's not right to do, you know, and he keeps doing it. At a certain point, you say to him, don't come to the temple anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's just doing this kind of damage.
Yes.
And so, you know, if that works on a certain level, maybe sometimes people who are out to do damage... They just have a philosophy they want, but they're actually, planning to do damage. They're planning to meet people, make lists of their names, contact them on the side. I just don't know that we should be so free and open that we give access to people like that.
I see, and that point is valid. But at one point, I was in the restaurant doing service, and these young girls came, you know, late at night as I was closing up the restaurant. And they said, we're on a Sankirtan party, or, you know, they were on a traveling party, they said. And, you know, can we have some food? I said, sure, no problem. They said, but you don't understand, we're from Columbus, and we're outside of ISKCON. And, you'd be careful, you know, it might not be a good thing. But, you know, years later I found out that these devotees were under the auspices of Mother Malati. And, you know, she was thankful that someone actually gave them prasadam, gave them shelter.
They were not preaching a philosophy opposed to Prabhupada.
No, and that's, I mean, my standard was, are those Prabhupada's books in your book bag? They said, yeah. I said, then here, you know, here at the body, please come take prasadam. You know, but it's this, you know, questioning of whose heart is true. You know, mine's, you know, filled with all kinds of problems and misgivings. And it's scary to me that this is based in fear, that you have to do it because, you know, that this may happen or that may happen. I think of, you know, the attack on the Mayapur temple and Bhagananda grabs a gun and shoots and kills someone. You know, he's protecting the deity, time and circumstance. There was no policy in place and none needed because, you know, he figured, hey, they're attacking, we have to stop them. And, you know, if someone's attacking this temple, I'll stop them. If I have to go get my mafia family to help, I'll help. You know, but I'm just...
Oh, yeah, you have a mafia family.
You know.
Interesting resource.
Yeah, it's a real
down.
All right. Well, once again, it all depends on evidence.
Yeah.
You know, the evidence has to be seen before judgment can be given.
Well, that, you know, I see. But some policy in place...
We have no currency.
It seems to be already seen. It's scary.
I'm sorry, I don't know the central reflection, but just I'm just an equal group of right perfect, which is perfect since thousands of millions of since Lord Brahma. So this we should be afraid and scared of these people. Because our Guru Parampara is so superior and so protected by Krishna, I think so just we have to be vigilant, but we don't have to be paranoid and just morbidly fearful of these people.
Well, I'm not morbidly fearful, I'm not paranoid. I'm just trying to protect the temple.
Yeah,
make sure that Prabhupada's legacy can go on.
That's
all. And like I said before, everybody's welcome until evidence shows that there is a problem. Simple as that.
Several people have passed their cards, and for the sake of those who have cooperated,
so let's
go
move
ahead.
Forward.
Good point. Procedural point.
So says here, what about conclusions out of the meeting held 3 weeks ago, such as code of conduct, notification, setup tribunal, financial reporting? Financial reporting is already going on. The other two things, that's up to the members who were in that meeting. You know, so, and I don't see any representatives from that meeting right now.
I wrote that note. The reason is, right in this room, we had that meeting, and you were president at that time. So there are a lot of conclusions out of that. And so those steps have to be taken. And
well, I think the conclusion of that meeting was that they were going to follow it up with another meeting.
Right, exactly.
Yes. This meeting doesn't have to do with that particular set of conclusions. Or this is Tagoshi today. It's a completely separate issue.
Okay.
So some article says GBCs were originally supposed to be voted in by temple presidents. Well, he'd already mentioned that.
Prabhupada, when he originally formed the GBC, he made a document called Directions of Management. And that called for the election of the GBC periodically by temple presidents. It never happened. It was never put into place. And then when the GBC had its first formal meeting as a board of directors, where notes were taken and put in the minutes book and everything, up until 75, that happened in 75, about the third resolution down, I can find it if you want to see it, whoever asked this question, was that there shall be no election of the GBC. That was the very first formal meeting. Prabhupada reviewed all those minutes and approved of them. So he knew very well that's how it was done. And then we also see in this May conversation of 77, when they asked him, how will the GBC go on? It should not get rid of a GBC man unless they've become fallen down or something like that. And if you need new people, they should be elected by the GBC. So this later statement overrides his initial idea of elections. He himself changed his mind about that.
This is also supported by some senior personal secretaries throughout this
time. Next question. Okay, doesn't the presence of a non-preaching Ritvik pose a threat? Any answers?
Doesn't one pose a threat?
I wrote that. When the presence of a non-preaching Ritvik in our community pose a threat, like, you know, to a new devotee who sees this, oh, he's a Ritvik, you know, maybe I want to be a Ritvik, you know, just his presence would say that, okay, I'm coming here, it's okay to be a Ritvik. You can be a Ritvik too. He doesn't have to say any philosophy, just his presence.
How do you know he's a Ritvik?
Because we all know each other.
Oh, come on.
We all know each other.
Ritvik Jews are.
That's true. That's true. We all do know each other. That's right. Thanks. I agree with that.
Yeah. We really all know
each other. A lot of us talk to each other. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just saying if this situation came up, you know. Like even if... you know, by evidence we found that they were, you know, not preaching Ritvik philosophy, but just a follower. And they weren't given a letter because they're not preaching. Because you said, you know, they can't preach, but they can be allowed to come. Mm-hmm. So that's obvious that this person would be a Ritvik, but they're not preaching, but they're still coming. They're coming to the Sunday feast. They may be doing service. So it's obvious that they're a Ritvik, but they're here. So their presence alone, even if they're not preaching, could be a threat.
So basically, the main point here is those persons who are propagating, preaching, they're coming into the temple, they're speaking to your congregation members, and then going out and, you know, trying to engage them. They're coming and they're passing out this, you know, offensive literature back to Prabhupada magazine. You know, we've had a picture of this horrible, offensive, vile word. So, you know, we're talking about actively pursuing within the temple here. But you can't change a person's heart. If they didn't believe this, this is right. But then go up on their own street corner. Don't come to our street corner and, you know, present your case. Just like we built, you know, all of you here who built this temple by following Prabhupada's instructions, but you didn't change it, didn't say you're doing the wrong thing, do it another way. and it's built on these solid instructions. If somebody has another idea, let them go build their own institution. You cannot stop that. You know, I mean, I can just tell you in Vrindavan, we had some very strong, you know, big community, that was a big place. So in the area of the community, there's a whole enclave of their personalities. And they started standing outside our Sunday peace, passing stuff out, and we asked them not to. They did it anyway. We asked them not to, and we had to give them a letter. If you do this one more time, you know, call the local authorities, and we already spoke to the local authorities to see if we had that right. And said, we have the right to ask to remove anybody from your premises if you don't want. So we, you know, it wasn't really really wanted to do that, but they didn't get the message when we asked them once, twice, you know. So we sent, gave them this letter. Since that time, there's been, as you can say, a truce. They come, they attend, and there's no proselytizing. So, you know, and that, yes, we know what they're thinking, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as they come and respectful, that's what we're asking here.
Let me just add something. Here's this letter. In 1999, the ISKCON Reform Group, they said, their letter, their first point is, we are not starting a society in isolation, but attempting to retake ISKCON. And they list what they think are their own temples they own now, which is... I think we get down to 8 temples or so. None of them in America, but the planned temples, they list New York in America and Montreal in Canada. They call these planned temples. There's Moscow and other things. And then what they call semi-temples is Alachua and Vrindavan in India. So we've stopped them in Vrindavan, and I think we've done it in Alachua. But we had to really undergo a struggle because they were planned takeover attempts. So it's one thing to have a philosophy that's different. It's another thing where if you're part of this program, and we just want to be sure that people are not part of this program.
A Muslim and a terrorist. A Muslim and a terrorist.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, plus it'd be pretty hard to try to set up a brain police. You try to monitor everybody else's opinion, because everybody's going to have different opinions, right, or different agreements and different ways.
I respect that. I'm just saying, my point was, if you know they're at some point an outspoken Ritvik, or there's evidence that they are Ritvik, just their presence alone would be a threat, because a new devotee and the temple would see.
But that we already established, that they are an outspoken Ritvik. If they are preaching Ritvikism or something
saying
like that,
preaching.
You know.
But you know what, that they are.
But that's what, to me, that's what an outspoken person would be. Okay. Someone who's preaching.
At this point in time, we're addressing activities within...
You can deal with those on a case-by-case basis if they show up.
If,
you know,
if new people are given the care that they should get when they come here, they'll be able to understand for themselves that this is bogus. You know, if new people are cared for and introduced to the talk, to the philosophy, and given friendship when they come into this temple, they won't be persuaded to go, you know, in another direction.
So next question, let's see. When I first joined, I remember Vedic Village Publishers, I think it says. What happened to VV? Does it still exist?
Vedic Village was wiped out by the United States government. There was no Vedic Village of you anymore either. As far as I know, it just disappeared. Then we had the internet soon after that. But then you used to publish a magazine, put it in the mail, send it out. You know, I had to do those things. I mean, there's some really far-out Ritvik websites if you want to start looking for them. They've got a whole thing where they rewrite the Prabhupada Lilamrita, you know, with commentaries, you know, whenever Satrup does something or somebody does something, they have a whole commentary about it. It's really, it's just too much.
It's actually deadly. Just like when Chaitanya advises, don't even listen. Even look at the Mayavada. And the poisonous contact, just like you, the epitome of this, I back to Calcutta magazine. It's just
terrible.
That you shouldn't even open the cover. You know, you're doing a disservice to your heart.
Some of us have to. It's our job. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm so sick of this issue. It's so boring philosophically. I was like the point man in 1990, and I just said, let the GBC deal with it now on. But I think I got to get back into it again. I hate it.
Next question. Okay. It says, have any letters been sent yet? No. How to deal with them after they're sent? That remains to be seen. Who will everyone know to whom letters have been sent? And I would think that we would prefer to do it on a private basis to begin with. If they cooperate, then that's all that needs to be done. If they don't cooperate, then obviously things will become a little more obvious.
Here's my first question.
We only get one question. Okay. Since it's your question, you can read it.
The temple that was trying to be taken over in India, I think you said Calcutta or something, are they going to be looked at as criminal if we do actually win in the court case?
I don't really know. Actually, there are criminal charges against Adu Dharm in Calcutta. I think that's why he's staying out. I don't know I don't know the details about that. It's not just a civil case there anymore.
This one is more, it doesn't seem like it's a question. Anyway, could the issue of Prabhupada's books being changed
be discussed or what? Somebody wants to talk about that?
I think that should be a separate,
I happen to mention that the Ritviks embrace that cause. That doesn't mean necessary. You know, the person who started it was actually Kirtanananda. Because he was busy changing everything, so it was convenient to say they changed Prabhupada. And of course, really what the editors were doing is, since we had Prabhupada's original manuscripts and things, were bringing it back to what Prabhupada had. But that's what they saw themselves as doing it. But the Ritviks, it's just another way of making a division. So, you know, you have your ISKCON scripture. I mean, you'd be hinting that your scriptures won't save you, but ours will, or something like that. You know, it's a kind of a cause that they have embraced. And now Hamsa Duda, who was one of the Zomacharyas and is now, in some degree or another, a Ritvik, is the one that sued the BBT. He's a big inspiration for them, and got the rights to publish separately from ISKCON. There's something called Krishna Book. You'll see sometimes you see a BBT book, but it won't be the BBT, it'll be Krishna Book Inc. So he has some rights to publish these things. Because when he was removed or replaced as a BBT trustee, he never did the paperwork, never had minutes. And so when he went to court, anyway, they finally had to settle with him. So we had to keep our papers in order and all those things like that. But in the early days of ISKCON, we didn't care so much about those things. They come back to haunt you.
Here's a question. Yeah, this is from, in the incident that took place a few Sundays ago, the Ritvik issue appeared to reach a level of fanaticism a senior Mataji was verbally, physically abused when my very presence in inquiry resulted in my being deemed a Ritvik.
That was me.
Yeah.
That's me.
Well, with this, hopefully by the use of this letter, and now that we're explaining to everybody that we intend to use this letter, this is the way we intend to, you know, inform any outspoken Ritviks that they're not going to be appreciated coming anymore. Hopefully, and I expect, that any situations like that will never happen again. That's one of the reasons why we want to use the technique that we're using. So like I've said before, any strong arm tactics will not take place. anything like that again.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the technique that was taking place, because just my coming into the group, and please accept my obligations as all glories assured above God, all glories to your days. But my coming into the gathering, someone pulled me into it. And the first question I asked was, very innocent, I thought, was, does everyone understand what Rithik is? I had neophyte and senior devotees verbally attacking just that question. When I inquired about the letter, someone told me I was not invited to the meeting, I should not be here. And at that point, a bhakta came and grabbed me and tried to physically remove me from the meeting. Now, that bhakta didn't know I had other extenuating circumstances and help, but he chose to do that anyway. And all of these devotees, senior devotees, and devotees that have taken diksha, not one came to defend me. I had to be, at one point, and only at that particular point, it was just me and this Prabhu, and it was like a standoff. And it was me trying to convince him to release me and to take his hands off of me. This should have never have happened in a temple. No Mataji, unless I give an invitation. You don't grab Matajis. You don't physically force them to do anything they don't want to do. You can usually tell by the condition of ISKCON as to how Matajis, seniors, and children are treated. Somehow or another, there's some comparison there. And my thing is that I am very respectful. I must take Guru. I stayed there and I questioned because I wanted to understand what was going on. And this Prabhu that did grab me called, and I'm still trying to release it from my heart because I can't afford to have that anger in my heart. But he told me that he did this because my question made him think I was Rithik. So it's becoming like, what was it, the McCarthy era, the witch hunt? We have to be very, very careful who we determine is this and who's that. And one Prabhu said, we all know each other. No, some of us do, still others don't. We really don't know each other. Otherwise, those Prabhus, forgive me, that opened their mouths would never have said what they said, and the Prabhu never would have done what he did, because I am very, very conscious of my Gurudev and Srila Prabhupada. And if someone came and wanted to change the temple into Rithik, I would be among the first to be there fighting. But it was just the whole procedure and the manner in which these two Prabhus that were considered Rithik were approached that day. All I could hear them saying was, please can we take darshan of the deities? Now, if they had said, can we come in and preach, I would be right there and I would be there fighting with you. But it tore my heart that we were denying, even if we had escorted these Prabhus to the deities, let them take darshan and leave. I never understood that we were to deny anyone unless we had actual, factual information and someone coming forward saying, yes, they did try to turn me into a Rithik. Those Prabhus, you see them differently. I see them differently. I'm on the committee for the Rathi Ashram. Whenever I needed anything, these Prabhus came forward, never tried to preach to me. They were always doing service. Now, I'm not saying that they were not Rithik. I'm just saying that the process that's in place needs to be fine-tuned. That was a horrible incident that happened previous week prior to that.
Just a minute. That is one of the things that we're trying to correct with this Istogoshi, so that everybody has a proper understanding of what the Rithik issue is and how to deal with the situation so that situations like that won't happen again. Of course, on the other hand, I do have to disagree that I did let Madhusudan go take darshan. He said he just wanted to meet a friend in the temple room, have darshan, and he'd be back in 5 minutes. And he was back in 5 minutes. That's when I was talking to him. as far as being said to be Ritvix or not, they personally both have given me Back to Prabhupada magazines in the past. There is no question. And that was what was being objected to. This thing has been going on with those two people. It's been going on for 2 years. This was not some incident that came up overnight or a past week or so. This has been going on for 2 years, and if you had had good relations with them, most people have. But, on the other hand, I also know that I was, like I said, when they had thought they had me in their confidence, they started giving me Back to Prabhupada magazines. And I don't know who else they may have done that to. So these are the kind of situations we also have to guard against. So it's a fine line between trying to do it, to do what's right, and to make sure no one else is affected negatively, or incidences that you experienced, you know, we try to make sure that will never happen again. At least I want to make sure it never happens again.
Once so, I'm not notified, I mean, I am considered a senior.
Notified of what?
That this process that took place was pre-planned. The day of the event when these Prabhus were evicted from the temple, this was pre-planned. Was I not qualified to at least sit in and listen and hear what was going on?
As far as I'm concerned, yeah, you were.
But I was not.
Well, according to one particular person, they may have had a different idea. So, but as far as I'm concerned, I had certain things I needed to say to Madhusudan and Sudhir, and then I left. Simple as that.
So I think, you know, at this point,
I'm going to go for Dan to say something.
Right.
We're trying to address situations so that there would not be a reoccurrence. In other words, this, because this happened, we were having this meeting today, giving a policy guideline so that such occurrences do not happen in the future. We're recognizing that certainly that was not in anyone's best interest the way it was enacted, although the intention was, you know, was right, the result didn't occur, and certainly that you were improperly, you know, touched and spoken to is not something that we want to be party to, and we want everyone to understand that. So at this point, what is trying to be established is a policy procedure for such type of situations if it has to happen, and to avoid such an occurrence as happened, unfortunately, to you itself.
First of all, I was standing right there in the middle of what was going on, and many people, including Jamavan, myself, and at least two other Matajis and Prabhus, told him specifically to take his hands off you. So it's not that everyone was pointing and laughing or just letting it happen to you. I was a party to it. Specifically, people, even Jamavan, said, take your hands off her.
I didn't say anyone was laughing.
And well, that was in regards to another letter that was addressed. But, and it was an honest mistake on the part of the Bhakta. It was not anything that anyone would think that would be right. And that was just his own thing that he happened to do that was a mistake. I would never say anyone should touch a woman. I don't feel like he was doing it out of anger or spite or anything. I just think he felt like you didn't know what was going on in the situation. He was going to take you aside and tell you later. I didn't feel like it was malicious or in any way trying to be offensive or hurtful. And the whole feeling of what was going on was in the utmost humility, and we're just trying to protect our community and humbly beg these people, just please don't come back again. There was not that feeling of hurt or anger or anything that was going on. And unfortunately, you didn't know about what was going on, and that was probably a mistake on whoever was, it wasn't like somebody went down the phone list and called. It was just like people who were concerned, they heard about what was going on, called other people who were concerned. And I want to apologize to you for what happened, and I hope that you can, you know, just on behalf of everyone. But I also want to understand that, you know, it wasn't in any way tolerated. No one thought that that was good to anyone. If I would have touched you, it wouldn't have been good, but especially a man should never touch a woman in that way. And I appreciate you coming forward and saying that, and I understand.
Maybe you didn't see that people were stopping it, but it was being stopped.
I didn't hear, and I knew that no one came forward to do anything or to remove him.
No, we did. We did come forward. And by that point, by the time it was a split second, he went like that, we came forward and the hands were gone, and it was, and we said, you should apologize immediately. Within 3 seconds, I was standing right here by John Bavon, and he said it loudly to him that it should be apologized. No one let that happen.
Actually, I guess in the room you can make a statement and pass it around the room, and it comes around to the last person, totally different than what was said before. My perception of the event and yours, unfortunately, are different. And that's unfortunate, because all this time, it has felt very lonely, very detached in this temple. And what has happened is we've begun to side. People have begun to decide, well, no, nothing happened to this Mataji. She's just making this up. And it's unfortunate because we're supposed to be looking at the Paramatma in our hearts and not determining this particular body or that particular body. You're supposed to actually spiritually tap in and see what took place, but as I said, our perception of what took place is different. I appreciate the fact that this meeting
But it wasn't is only my perception. I'm just making it known that this was the fact what did happen.
I was there too, many witnesses saw this.
It was different for you because you were in the middle of what was happening. You may not have perceived everyone's outside actions as clearly as we did. I'm speaking as a bystander. I personally would never let someone touch a woman.
I
would remove him myself.
I hear you.
If I saw somebody doing something out of line.
And I appreciate what you said, but each person that's just said they were there, those are also the places where the verbal abuse came from, the directions. And I couldn't figure out why. You know, each
Everyone
one of you
who I
said,
heard
please,
speak to
please
you.
Not
to you.
Please, please, please. Each one that has said they were there and they saw, those are the directions that the insults and the verbal abuse was coming from. And as I said, we're all different. We all have different perceptions of what takes place. What happened to me was more than 3 seconds. What you saw, what anybody else saw, totally different. But my point is, it did not happen to you. It happened to me.
Yeah, we're running out of time.
This really needs to be addressed because this has been an ongoing issue throughout the community, letters, things being talked about, this one incident, which is completely polluting the whole issue. It needs to be dealt with.
Maybe we could continue after the last few questions. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I was there too, and quite honestly, I saw exactly what happened. I was right in front of you. And I have to say that whatever Adi Gopi is saying is my version as well. The next question is, please discuss the Ritvik movement's policy on ISKCON devotees preaching at Bangalore or elsewhere, since we are more inclusive than they are. Sunny?
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened when I went to Bangalore.
Go ahead.
Okay, what happened in Long Island?
Before it actually was, you know, at one point there was tension, but it hadn't been conclusive. So they were there occupying the building, but it hadn't been conclusive to the court that they had the possession of the building. So we sent in one sannyasi to preach. This is what sannyasis are supposed to do. Actually, we sent two, Chandrashekhar Swami and Jayadvaita Swami. And Jayadvaita, very senior man, Chandrashekhar Swami is, you know, quite senior, but not as well known. But they were refused, and they gave instead the Vyasa sign to a non-initiated devotee to give the lecture.
And Bangalore?
Well, yeah, I was arranged. I was going to come and visit the Bangalore temple. I was the chairman of the GBC. It was all set up. When I arrived, I was met at the airport, and they said, "You can't come." We changed our minds. I stayed at Lightman's house. And so finally, some agency was agreed that I come to visit the temple for the greeting of the deities. So I came for the greeting of the deities, and first they had Guru Puja, and people really made sure that, you know, nobody did anything to like bring the ghee lamp first or anything like that. You know, it was like very ostentatiously. And then when it came to greet the deities, you know, nobody was going to give me a standing place or anything like that. It was systematically. And finally, there was one elderly man in the congregation who kind of thought this was pretty rude. And so by the time we went to greet the Nisringa deities, he went way in first and saved me a place so I could come and sit down.
Wow.
And then, so that was like that was the way they did it there. And of course, I couldn't open my mouth, but yeah.
So they have a similar attitude that they don't want ISKCON being preached.
They knew I wasn't going to preach. They just wanted to like make sure, you know, because I was an ISKCON guru that I didn't get any respect whatsoever.
So, next
or
question.
GBC chairman for that matter.
Next question.
That was
Can we just go through these questions and then we'll address whatever's left? We only got three more. So,
just being thorough here.
At what point is it appropriate to inform a new person or bhakta about Ritvik's situation?
I'd say it depends on the person or bhakta. When they ask or what's, if it comes up, I don't know that you have to like give everybody a fact sheet.
It's not possible.
The Ritviks and the Ryan Maharajs, this, that, this.
Again, it comes down to us meeting and reading and taking care of newcomers and existing devotees.
Mm-hmm. Next question is, Ritvik initiation process sounds like the current practice of baptism in Christianity. Wouldn't ISKCON become more like Christianity if we were to adopt the Ritvik process?
Well, it depends on if you're Protestant or it depends. Some people have baptism late, some people have it early. And sometimes you're supposed to make a decision. Depends on your sect. But it's to me it's like a very modern, this notion, you know, that the basically the savior is Jesus Christ, and after that nothing else. There's no acknowledgement of the role of a teacher because really wherever there's really spiritual life, there's a guru, even if it's not in name. There's somebody who helps, leads, gives mercy. And it goes on in every tradition, if that tradition is alive. Because the point of parampara is not just to pass down a message, it's to pass down spiritual energy from one generation to another. So people, whatever original spiritual experiences there at the beginning are somehow or other repeated generation after generation. It's a flow of spiritual energy. And if that doesn't happen, it's a dead tradition. And I think Krishna consciousness, with the idea of parampara, just really states what is the reality. And if you have a living tradition, even if it's not Vedic or Vaishnava, they'll have something like that. Yeah, it could be that way. You know, you can see sometimes like the Saint Francis came, and then for some time after him, there was some spiritual potency that was going down, and then, you know, maybe it dies out. We also have, paramparas disappear too. We want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. In some ways too, it's like if you want to take Ritvik to the extreme, well then,
if I'm going to go for Ritvik initiation, why stop at Prabhupada? Why not go to Bhaktisiddhanta or Lord Chaitanya or Krishna himself?
It works, goes backwards. Yeah, sure.
If I'm a disciple of Krishna, I'm senior to all of you. But, you know, it's total, that's
better
ridiculous
than Brahma, huh?
Yeah. Will someone please speak to the controversial issue of preaching Ritvik or ISKCON property to innocent guests and devotees? Well, I think we've been doing that all the whole session. So anyway, I think that's, before we go on with the continuation of the issue that we were talking about previously, I just want to thank everybody for attending the Ishtagoshti. Hopefully we've cleared up as much as possible, and hopefully we've established from now on what kind of tactics and strategies we're going to use, which will also prevent, you know, previous situations from happening again. We can only try as much as possible, and from now on, if there is something that's held suspect of being Ritvik or something like that, then you can take it to the information or the evidence. We really want the evidence as opposed to any hearsay. You can take that to either myself, Jagaguru, or Giri Govardhan, and the three of us will discuss it ourselves or discuss it with the person that has been in question, and just take it from there. And, you know, that way no one else needs to, you know, take it up as their own initiative or their own rumors to spread or their own project to rectify. So hopefully, go ahead, Sukade.
Prabhupada made it very clear to us that as disciples, we're to chant 16 rounds, and we're to follow the four order principles, and we're to read Prabhupada's books. And in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says that if you're doing these things, then you actually have the spiritual strength to be able to defeat yourself against any philosophy that is not Krishna consciousness. It's not that there are not philosophies, there are philosophies that are against or might not be Krishna conscious. But if we're not doing these things, if we don't chant 16 rounds, and if we don't follow the four regular principles, and if we don't read the books, then we will not actually have the spiritual strength to actually see that this is not Krishna consciousness. What to speak of having the spiritual strength to be able to deal with it. So it's not really complicated. Chant 16 rounds. Follow four regular principles. And Prabhupada makes it very clear that you should be reading his books. There are many people who are not reading the books. They haven't read Bhagavad Gita, and who knows when? Even if you're reading one verse a day, then it becomes very clear. Well, this is Krishna consciousness, this is not Krishna consciousness. So if we're doing those things, then after the problem should be actually medical.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I would also like to make unification. Yes. We're all doing these things.
And one thing that happened to me personally when I joined the movement in 1966, and I'm not understanding anything at all about Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada was so powerful, is that I was sitting there and Prabhupada was preaching, and then there was some Christian person, and he was going on and on about his Christian philosophy, and Prabhupada wasn't saying one word to him at all. He was simply looking at Lord Jagannath. And I'm sitting there in the audience. And then at the end, Prabhupada says, "Are you through?" And then he finished, and then Prabhupada did not say it. He screamed it at the top of his lungs. He said, "Christ said, thou shalt not kill! Why are you killing?" And I'm sitting there, I'm like, Prabhupada became Bhajan Shingji. And I had never thought about being a vegetarian. All the nonsense was gone. It was gone immediately. Few words of Prabhupada. It was gone. So that was the pure word. So by Krishna's grace, we understand Krishna consciousness. We can, it may be something controversial, we can speak to them nicely. This is, is not our philosophy. This is not pure pagan philosophy. But if we don't have the spiritual strength, you're not going to be able to deal with it individually. Chant 16 rounds, follow for the principles, read all first books.
We have one more question right here.
Okay.
Well, I didn't have a question. That was my question about Bangalore. And I just, I met several devotees when we were in India last time, traveling brahmachari, some Indian and some European. And they were all like regaling each other with stories of what happened to them when they tried to visit Bangalore. And they're all young guys, not notable, not leaders of ISKCON. And they were all told, don't pass out anything. Don't give anyone your email address. Here is your personal guard who will go with you. And on threat of like being beaten by the guards, like don't invite anyone to any programs or, you know, it's kind of like, you'd rather not even go.
It's a cult.
Like, they have so much fear going on there. Like, you could be beaten. It's India, you know, by the...
It's true.
The Chokidars like got a machine gunner, you know, like they always have like a little rifle. You know? So if we're just asking people to not preach and giving them a letter, we shouldn't feel like we're fascists or something.
It's a good point. Very good point. Over.
I just wanted to bring up an issue about the Madhusudan and Sudhir incident. The whole thing was arranged that we would approach them very humbly, which we did. There was no verbal abuse, no names were called. We said that you're, you know, philosophically deviant and we do not want you here. We humbly request you to leave. It was a completely humble atmosphere. I saw the incident with Mother Antarami, and it was, in your mind it might have seemed like forever, but it was a matter of a few seconds. You were not jerked around, and Prabhu was, you know, asked to stop and to apologize. And the atmosphere, there was just a lot of devotees there, and everyone was just saying, please leave, please leave. So from an outsider, it might have looked chaotic, but it was completely organized and a humble attempt to ask these two devotees to leave. And that's, well, all I wanted to say about it.
Anything else?
But nonetheless, she even humble attempts sometimes stumble, so we kind of stumbled humbles, you know, and I think that's what happened in this case, and hopefully, you know, there's been a learning curve here, and it won't happen again.
I mean, personally, when I saw it, I was also a little shocked that it happened, and after the whole incident, after everything had calmed down, I personally went to him and I said, you know, you've got to set this straight now. You've done this, you've got to apologize, you know, make sure you, you know, get back in touch with you and clarify the situation and apologize, because this never should have happened, and it can't go on, you know, not being resolved to some degree. And I think he's tried to do that. I think, you know, we can only hope that that kind of situation will never happen again. It also depends. If we are all chanting our 16 rounds, reading Prabhupada's books, then that should give the impetus to cleanse our own heart to make sure that these kind of situations don't ever happen again. And we have to make sure that we don't offend others. And we also, because it shows our disconnection from Krishna if we do. We also have to make sure also that if we are offended, we can let go of that at some point, understanding that we're all neophytes, we're all simply struggling to make some advancement. It's because if we hold on to it, then that not only obstructs our own Krishna consciousness, but the offense itself, hanging on to it, also shows our own disconnection from Krishna, or chanting our 16 rounds, or reading Prabhupada's books, or whatever. You know, it's hard to be a pure devotee, naturally. But even in the description of Ambarish Maharaj in the Bhagavatam, you know, Daksha was creating so many offenses. But he was so pure, he never saw one offense. So we have to also try to reach that position as best we can. Even though I know for many of us, including me, it's going to be very hard. But at least if we know the standard and can continue trying to attain that standard, then at least there's some hope for all of us.
Thank you.
So, Jamavati?
Just want to say this. I personally know what it feels like to be physically attacked, and not to think that you have the support, you know, of the community. Because that happened to me not too long ago. I was in the company of Mother Rasa. A situation happened. I'm not going to go into what the detail was. But the point is that I was very, very, you know, angry, very, very hurt that it would happen. Very angry that this person thought they even had the audacity to do that. But the person did apologize. Mm-hmm. And I had to accept it and move on. So.
Dermakesh?
Yeah, because when something happens, you know, and someone apologizes, if you don't take it to your heart, you know, you have to take it in your heart. You have to let it go. Because what happens is that it destroys your love, your ability to love. Yes. You know what I'm saying? That's what we're going to do, is to be able to love each other and forgive. Because, you know, none of us, all of us, make offenses to each other every day, 10 times a day.
Every day.
And we're all right.
Actually, that is what I said. I am trying very, very,
just, you know, you
hard to release it.
And, you know, like I said, I'm helping with substance abuse. And I was telling Srinan, the minister said one thing, you know, that really touched me. He said that you can miss going back to heaven by 18 inches. And I was thinking you miss going back to God by 18 inches. And he said that's the connection between your mouth and your heart.
That's funny. Yeah.
Good point.
Is there anyone that has pins and or any cards to return them? Drop me in the basket as you're leaving.
This is the time for me to hand this over to you. And did I mention it's from, remember my mother got some Dr. Prabhupada's?
Oh,
did I mention that? I did mention it to you.
Maybe you did, I didn't realize.
They came to my mom.
Oh, that's, yeah, this is from Mumbai, right?
Yep. Yeah. Mumbai. I've been hanging on to it just in case somebody wanted it. I don't really want to hang on to it anymore.
Yeah, right.
We were staying with my mom, so I pretty much imagined that it's addressed to Elvinger, her name. But it's how she's listed in the phone book. So I think someone did a reverse phone number lookup because we were using her phone number. Otherwise,
yeah.
Nobody knows her name or address. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
There.
Right.
But Krishna protected me. I was sick. But coincidentally, Mother Sagan did know our phone number. And doesn't know our name. So it seems plausible, but not definitive. That because only a very few people had that number. It wasn't on the phone list or anything.
Yeah, it was horrible.
I said, why did she just take initiation? Must be that. And unless it was like Saraswati or Buddy Gopher, like somebody was calling me at my mom's
name.
But it's so violent, so bad.
Okay. So I'm serious now. Hanuman was trying to read it on the way here, so I'm glad I'm getting rid of it. And I was like, don't pick up. He's like, I want to see what it says.
I can't.
Okay.
No, I can come. I'm going to come too.
you're pretty.
We're working so hard. I was supposed to bring flyers. The 23rd of September, we're having a big blowout rock theater.
Yeah.
Right in the Lotus Rocky Balboa.
Oh, that's
what it is. They just installed.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're right in front of the Red Sun Yard Museum.
First time since 92.
Oh, no, we had Rafiaches a little later than that.
I remember I was at one.
Betty's little card.
Jewish festival.
Yeah.
Exactly, but we also
yeah, then after that, they get us. It was about 10 years.
Oh,
10, 11 years we've had since we had a Rafiache. And this is a big festival.
Oh, it's
going to
be
the
biggest one.
It's going
to be one of the last ones.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's the end of the season for Rafiache.
You know, you've
got to
be careful with
how much. We tried to get an earlier date, but everything's now they got one place where you do parades and one place where you have the festival, which is just oval in front of the yard.
So it's not a
huge one? Yes, much shorter. Try to give us some list go around the oval once. Because
yeah.
It's actually very hard to make the turn if you don't do that. And oh, yeah. But I was there, I talked about it in class this morning. I was there on Thursday morning, you know, talking to the cops and the park officials and everything, and getting it all arranged for mother devotees. And there's helicopters that were hovering overhead, and I said, police, what's going on? There's an accident. He pointed up there. There's this flatbed truck and a crane starting to put up the statue.
It was there before, right?
Well, it was years and years ago. They had it at the top of the stairs, right in front of the art museum.
Right.
And the art museum people knew that it was, as far as art goes, it's a piece of trash. So it was moved down in front of the Spectrum Stadium. And then ended up in storage. So there's a whole big thing to bring it back. So finally it's going at the bottom of the stairs.
The same stairs?
Yeah, but people came from all over to see this installation. Because when I was there, they had all these TV vans and everything, and they were just putting it up. The next day was the Abhishek and the installation, you know. But this electrician said that when he's working there, he sees tour buses stopping all the time. They stop at the base of the stairs. They run up the stairs. And they got his footprints there, right? They run up the stairs and they stand there and his footprints, you know, go run back down and get the bus and go. And some of them, they actually go and they take the dust. You know? They don't do this, but they rub the footprints.
He was there probably for the...
He was there for the installation. I saw a picture of him. Little because the Rocky statue is 8.5 feet. Tall, not as best as the one he ever was, even in his best of days. But bronze is immortal, but dead.
Thank you so much for your wonderful detailed explanation of this whole issue.
I think I should send my note, my minutes draft. It's not
like
to look at it.
I saw you writing furiously trying to get everything out.
Actually, I have a tape recorder going, so we can. Yeah, so you can. I'll send you the tape. So, but.